I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. When it was ratified in 1787, the U.S. Constitution stood alone as a beacon of freedom from tyranny and an unparalleled attempt to create a republic controlled by the people, with each branch of government serving as a check on the power of the other. Has the power of the executive branch and the many agencies it controls grown too much as the country has grown and the apparatus of government has expanded? Did the founders anticipate the political polarity of the current moment? What norms underlie the Constitution, and are they being abandoned? University of Baltimore Law Professor Kim Whaley has written a how-to guide for understanding this singular and significant contribution to political history. It's called How to Read the Constitution and Why. We'll talk about it when Midday starts after these headlines. Hi, everybody. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Today, a conversation about one of the most revolutionary and singular documents in human political history. When it was ratified in September of 1787, the U.S. Constitution stood alone as a beacon of freedom from tyranny and an unparalleled attempt to codify unalienable rights and create the structure of a republic in which neither an individual nor a branch of government can acquire controlling power. As law professor Kim Whaley reminds us in her excellent book, each branch of government has not one but two bosses, and no individual constitutional power is absolute. The Constitution does not include a checklist of American values, but it does rely on certain norms outside of the document itself to preserve individual liberty and hold government accountable. Her book is a how-to guide for understanding the Constitution and why those norms are required for it to remain that beacon of freedom for America and the world. Kim Whaley is a professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law. The book is called How to Read the Constitution and Why. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we won't be able to take your phone calls, emails, and tweets. Kim Whaley, welcome.
Thank you, Tom.
I really, really enjoyed this book. It's a terrific read, and it's revelatory on any number of levels. So thank you so much for that. The first thing I want to talk about is the terms that people bandy about when they talk about how various people interpret the Constitution. This comes up particularly when there are Supreme Court justices being nominated. We hear originalist, literalist. I've even heard people say constitutionalist, referring to people on the right side of the political spectrum as if Sonia Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg don't care about the Constitution. When it comes to literal or so-called strict readings of the Constitution, you say that it's really, that's a myth.
It's a myth to read the plain language as having one meaning. Yeah, I mean, the Constitution is old, and I talk about in the book how it really is like a poem or an older religious document, the Bible, the Quran. It requires interpretation. There are ambiguous terms, and there are different theoretical approaches to how to resolve the ambiguity. Some justices might look, for example, to contemporary definitions from the 18th century. But the suggestion that, for example, unreasonable in the Fourth Amendment, referring to unreasonable searches and seizures, has only one obvious definition, that itself is a myth. Both sides of the political spectrum and those in between on the federal bench interpret the Constitution. The debate is what sources are appropriate for resolving that ambiguity, but they all do it. That's the job of judging.
Yeah. And so this notion of it being a living, breathing document that's somehow very different now than it was in 1787 or 1887 or 1987, for that matter, that's just sort of that's not the right way to frame it, it sounds like. That's one of the arguments you're making, to say, you know, it's not as if it was fixed at one time and then other people came along and said, no, it's no longer fixed.
Well, and I think the problem with it is suggesting that somehow judges that fall into the living constitutional camp in some people's point of view are not judging or are doing something inappropriate. They're all doing what is required, that is interpreting ambiguous language. And when any Supreme Court justice does that on behalf of the court, that is in a way changing the Constitution, because when the Supreme Court interprets an ambiguous term, that is almost like amending the Constitution, because the only way to change that interpretation in terms of controlling law is to amend the Constitution or have a new court reverse itself, both of which are very hard to do and extremely rare. So the suggestion that there are good judges and bad judges based on their interpretive method, because some are going, you know, off the rails and some are staying within, you know, coloring within the lines, I think that's the problem that I try to dispel in the book, the idea that we can judge judges that way. I think that's unfair.
And it's really fascinating when you think clearly about this, how certain words appear on the surface to be pretty clear, but they're not so much. I mean, you mentioned, for example, the Article 2 of the Constitution, the executive power shall be vested in the President of the United States of America. And that's not as clear as it appears to be. What does shall mean, and what does executive power mean?
Exactly. So shall, you can ask yourself, does that mean no one else can utilize that power? If that's the case, the entire government contracting apparatus, that is, when private firms are hired by government to help executive branch agencies do their jobs, that arguably would be unconstitutional. Likewise, the question of what does execute the law mean? When you think about, I think traditionally it would be a police officer, a prosecutor that take a law from somewhere else, Congress, for example, and implement it, decide, well, we think this individual might have violated it. Well, then what's a regulation, which is created by agencies that answer to the president? Those are laws. What's an executive order? We hear a lot about executive orders. That is a law. That's creating a rule. So is that executing the law, or is that really legislating? If it's legislating, is it unconstitutional then for the president to issue an executive order? The answer is no, in terms of how the Supreme Court has looked at this, but that is not itself answered in the text of the Constitution.
You mentioned that there are some 76 federal agencies that have law enforcement powers. They have law enforcement authority. So it's not that as if law enforcement is only police, the FBI, etc. I mean, it's enforcing the law, executing the laws, spreads over a pretty wide pool of people.
And those agencies, as I mentioned, also legislate, because when we hear about regulation, deregulation, a regulation is an act of an agency that's implementing a statute. Congress passes something really vague, the Federal Trade Commission Act, that makes unfair trade practices unlawful. I'm paraphrasing. So someone has to interpret unfair. Agency issues lots of regulations. Those regulations function like laws. Agencies also have what we call administrative law judges. They're judges. They're not sitting in a federal courthouse. They are not appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, but they are judging. So there's a lot of mixing of the powers of the three branches. And this does get, I think, unsettling for people, because it's not black and white. The law is gray. Constitutional law is gray. And I tell my students, if it were black and white, something you could Google and answer on Wikipedia, you would not be hired by someone to actually resolve hard questions. Lawyering can be difficult. And that ambiguity is, I think, something that is lost in our black and white political and legal conversations nationally.
Yeah, and those on the political right make the argument that these, way back to Spiro Agnew days, you know, the pointy-headed bureaucrats in Washington making these regulations, these laws, burdening people with regulations and too many laws, they are unelected. So that somehow if these regulations emanate from part of the executive branch of government, it diminishes democracy.
That's a legitimate argument, and that's an argument that some members on the Supreme Court, like Justice Thomas, have found persuasive, and many academics debate that very question. That being said, there are certainly regulations and lawmaking on the conservative side of things as well. For example, we just went through this year in 2019 a national debate around whether to add a citizenship question to the census. That decision was made through a regulation, essentially, or that process by an executive branch actor, Wilbur Ross.
In the Commerce Department.
And the Commerce Department. So, and that was obviously supported by the conservative wing of the Supreme Court, as well as many people in the populace. So that's an exercise of legislative power by a bureaucrat, an unelected bureaucrat. So again, we have to be careful about lumping these hard legal questions into one political camp and another political camp. We all do it. I used to be in the federal government, wherever you are politically, if you're executing your job with integrity, you're acknowledging that there's ambiguity, and it's not really a political judgment. It requires focus on sort of empirical facts and policy, which I also talk about in the book, which is about good decision making. And that's a conversation I don't think we have enough either in this country.
Yeah, that distinction between policy and politics. And it's so difficult. I mean, as I read the book, it constantly struck me how difficult it is to keep politics out of it. And in this day and age now, where it seems that the political bifurcation, the polarity of political extremes is, you know, has never been wider. I mean, perhaps it was wider in the 19th century or something, who knows. But it's very difficult to excise political judgments or political orientations from these interpretations in these gray areas.
Yeah, I mean, I draw the distinction between politics and policy in that politics is sort of ideological. I'm on this team and I want a win for this team versus, okay, we have these facts, we have these different objectives. And from a policy standpoint, we might, for example, believe in a lot of deregulation of the environment. We might agree, we might believe in regulating business with respect to impacts on the environment. But we're going to have that debate based on a common set of facts. And this is what the court does, for example, when it comes to strictly or more different kinds of reading of the Constitution. They start with basic language. They start with precedent, and then they might depart, and some might call that political. But that's really different from saying, I'm on this team, I'm on that team. Who cares about what the facts are? Who cares about the counterarguments? I want my team to win. And I think it's that level of politics that is sort of colored our national conversation in a way that sort of the softer political influences maybe do not.
You talk about norms and how they undergird the Constitution and how they are necessary for the Constitution to function and for the Republic, ergo the Republic to function. What do you mean by that? Give us an example.
Well, I think accountability is a norm that is not anywhere expressed in the Constitution, but is implicit in our structure. You mentioned in the intro the idea that every branch has two bosses. You know, so the judicial branch is checked by the executive and the legislature. The legislature is checked by the other two. And the idea is, if you assume nobody is above the law, and ultimately the boss is the people through the Constitution, everyone has to have a check. That's a norm, the idea that there's accountability. It's not anywhere expressed in the Constitution. We also have conversations pretty regularly over the years on this notion of American values. The idea of integrity, honesty, hard work, the American dream, decorum in a manner of, you know, foreign relations or certain ways we expect people to act in public office. None of that is in the Constitution. But I think just in regular life, what I say, you don't wear necessarily, you know, short shorts to the Kennedy Center for an opera, not because you're going to be arrested, but because it's a norm of decorum that's not really appropriate in certain circumstances. Likewise, that's how we've come to expect our government to act. When those norms get broken, people say, wait a minute, how can X or how can Y do that? Well, there's nothing banning it in the law. It's a norm that socially we uphold. If we don't uphold it, then it goes.
It's a reflection of the values. But as you mentioned in the book, the Constitution doesn't list, it doesn't enumerate American values. As a matter of fact, it spends a lot of time simply saying what the government can't do.
Correct. It is a job description. It's a job description for the three branches of government that are exercising the people's power. And I've written on this in academic journals, the idea that all power ultimately has to go back to the people under that theory. And there has to be some kind of electoral check, which might be, to your earlier point, an argument against administrative agencies that are not elected, exercising a lot of power, for example. But in law, everything is balanced. There's the idea of practically how do we run the government? Can Congress do everything? Does Congress have the expertise? The court has said no, so we're going to tolerate lawmaking by agencies. That balancing happens across the board. And again, we lose that sometimes, the recognition that that law and policy is about balancing various interests.
Yeah. And for example, when Congress passed a very controversial bill several years ago, the Dodd-Frank legislation. So the point of the legislation is to regulate the financial markets. But they didn't say do this, 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 and this. They said to the Treasury Department, write the rules. And they had to, because 465 Congress people, or whatever the number is, don't know enough about the intricacies of the financial markets to, you know, in any vaguely erudite way, figure out what regulations make sense and what are fair. And there are a lot of people who worry mightily that the executive power, or the executive branch, of which the Treasury is part of it, is too powerful.
I think lately it seems like it's not as much the agency's exercise of power, but the presidency itself. The office of the presidency is getting bigger and bigger with each administration in terms of exercising sort of raw executive commander-in-chief power. But sure, we don't want, for example, airplanes unregulated so they crash into each other in the sky. No one wants that. We have to have regulations in order to have a safe and fair society to some degree. And then, as you mentioned, not only does Congress not have the expertise, but we're in such a polarized era of government where substantive policy is not coming out of the Congress. We might get appropriations, we might not. We've seen, you know, unprecedented government shutdowns based on budgets. As far as sweeping policy change, regulations that, or laws, I should say, that implement these kinds of objectives and make social change, we're just not in that world anymore with this Congress. So it is moving more to the executive branch agencies because Congress is stuck.
Kim Whaley is a professor of law at the University of Baltimore Law School. Her new book is called How to Read the Constitution and Why. I'm Tom Hall. My conversation with Kim Whaley was recorded earlier, so we're not able to take your calls, emails, and tweets today. Midday continues with Kim Whaley after a quick break. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us today, Kim Whaley is my guest. She's a professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law. She's been practicing as an attorney for more than 25 years. She's also a consultant at CBS News. We're discussing her terrific book, How to Read the Constitution and Why, which was published in June. It's kind of a handbook for understanding what the Constitution means and what parts of it are particularly open to a variety of interpretations. Kim Whaley and I pre-recorded our conversation, so we won't be able to take your phone calls, emails, or tweets. The book, Kim, is called How to Read the Constitution and Why. And like a good law professor, the word why is capitalized and circled in with big red pen. Why is it important that John Q. Public, Jane Q. Public really understand the Constitution in a particular way?
Well, I think there's also a myth that somehow the Constitution itself is protecting our individual rights. I call it the cop on the block myth, the idea that the Constitution, is this piece of paper, will fly in and save us when government gets too powerful or when individual rights are violated. The way the Constitution works is like a contract. It has to actually be enforced at the ballot box or in court, for example, if a government actor is violating it. So I think the why is for regular Americans to understand how the Constitution functions and what their role is in protecting what we take for granted often as our individual rights and freedoms in this country, and to do so in a thoughtful, informed way before, you know, things get sort of harder to turn around. The ship gets harder to turn around, and our children and grandchildren are living in a different kind of environment than we've grown accustomed to.
The responsibility for protecting those rights doesn't just lay or lie with people in the government.
It's quite the opposite.
The judges, the cops, the president, the Congress.
It's quite the opposite. I mean, that's why we have these three-headed monster of government, so to speak. The idea that the framers broke a monarchy up into three parts, that no one's above the law, and they understood that it's human nature to amass power and to use power to maintain their power, to secure your power indefinitely. And when that happens, individual rights are what go by the wayside. And so the idea is the power of any elected or appointed official is ultimately checked by the people. But if the people aren't aware of how it works, or are cynical about whether their vote matters, or don't understand, right, that they have a civic and practical responsibility for ensuring that that document has meaning, then the document itself loses its meaning.
The framers anticipated an awful lot of things. The genius of the framers certainly comes through in every page of this this exegesis of the Constitution. One of the things they anticipated was factions. They knew that everybody wasn't going to just get along. We were not going to have, you know, day after day of kumbaya moments. How did they anticipate them? And how does that anticipation play into this current political moment, which, as we've mentioned, is just so bifurcated and just so polarized?
So prior to the Constitution, we had a document of government called the Articles of Confederation, and it created a very small federal government. There was not an executive with tremendous power, and elections were direct elections, counting up votes. And I think it's a fair question to ask, why don't we do it that way? The framers were worried that there would be, as you mentioned, factions, that people would become so ideologically biased and make decisions based on emotion and based on bad information, propaganda that's circulating, that factions could then sort of overcome rational thought and good policy for the government and the populace as a whole. So
sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Right. And so with the Constitution, the Constitutional Convention in 1787 was supposed to actually just tweak that document, the Articles of Confederation. And they said no, they started over, and they created a republic where we have representatives that are there to cast votes on our behalf, but not necessarily are mandated to vote with the beliefs of the majority, for example, that there are old, and back then it was white, you know, landowners, males. So the Constitution hasn't always protected all people equally. That's evolved over the years. But that was the notion. There's a lot of problems with how that's functioning today in Congress, with how campaigns are financed and with gerrymandering and et cetera. But that was the idea. And of course, now we've got big data, we have technology, we have Russians trying to influence how we think about the issues, and factual distortions and highly polarized emotional sort of team mentality. That is precisely, I think, why the framers set it up this way and not with a direct democracy.
Talk about technology and how it's evolved, and how the evolution of technology has dramatically affected our understanding. Everything from the technology of what a firearm can do to, as you mentioned, the internet and social media.
It cuts across the law in so many ways, and the law hasn't caught up with technology. It's way behind the eight ball in this regard, and the law moves fairly slowly. So we see it anywhere from, I mentioned earlier, the Fourth Amendment, the question of what's a search. Certainly an originalist might look to what the framers of the Constitution thought and imagine you live in your little home in one of the colonies, and a British soldier comes and bangs down your door and rifles through your chest of all your precious documents and takes the original only copies of your parchment personal diary, for example. They didn't want that. They didn't want this idea of a general warrant. The king had the power in England to just go through whatever, all your personal stuff. Today, how are searches done? In part by taking data that we have willingly given to on the internet, swipes, clicks, photos. That data is aggregated in private servers, and the government has access to that, purchases it, some of it's free, puts an algorithm on it, and then can actually manufacture very detailed personal information. So the question, is that a search? It's certainly far afield of what happened in
1787. Yeah, we're coughing that up voluntarily.
Right, voluntarily. And the law has evolved to say if it's voluntary, if you basically allow the police in your house, you hand over the documents, you can't say that was an unlawful search. So the Supreme Court is having to struggle, both conservatives and liberals, progressives, with that question. How do we protect privacy, which also is nowhere in the Constitution, that word, there's a norm for you. How do we protect privacy in light of the fact that technology has just shifted the ability of government and the private sector, for example, that's not bound by the Constitution, the ability to government to snoop in unprecedented ways based on what we're giving them, information we give them.
Kim Whaley, the book is called How to Read the Constitution and Why. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we're not taking calls and emails today. You do a article by article, amendment by amendment, explanation of each part of the Constitution. I was fascinated by all of it. The First and Second Amendment are perhaps the two amendments that, you know, have garnered so much attention over the years. First Amendment law is massive. It's one little paragraph, but boy, oh boy, it has engendered all sorts of interpretations. And it's interesting what the framers decided to include, what they didn't include, and the particular language they used.
Yeah, so there's two parts of it. It's religion and speech. This is a conversation that is brought up a lot also in the national news in terms of, oh, those are my First Amendment rights, or that's violating someone's First Amendment rights. A couple things to keep in mind. The Constitution itself only limits government behavior, with perhaps the exception of the 13th Amendment's ban on slavery. So when a government actor says, listen, this violates my constitutional rights, that's off. So the law slices and dices who you are, what kind of speech it is, what the forum is, all of these tests and subtests that really a constitutional First Amendment expert, legal expert is needed to be brought in to really kind of move through that. But that's an example of how strict reading of the Constitution has blossomed into this notion of many tiers of analysis. The other piece has to do with government infringements on religion. Now, does that mean that we cannot, the government can't establish a national religion and punish people for not from being a member? Of course. But where's the stop line for that? Is it that any endorsement of a religion, what does endorsement mean? These are nuances that evolve over many years and many cases, and you have to reconcile them, and that's what makes the Constitution messy and difficult.
Separation of church and state is nowhere in the Constitution, like checks and balances, you mentioned, nowhere in the Constitution. Separation of powers isn't in the Constitution. But these little clauses and these little adjectives are really interesting. Congress shall make no laws that prohibit the free exercise of religion. Well, what's the difference between the free exercise and just the exercise of religion?
Exactly. And this is why the first question you asked me about constitutional interpretation, living constitutionalists versus strict constructionists or originalists, oftentimes judges will look to the reason behind the First Amendment, for example, to understand what it means. And I think the framers, in part, were worried about the idea that if government regulates speech and punishes people for how they speak, pretty soon they're managing your thought, because your speech is a reflection of how you're thinking. If you're worried about being, punished by the government for how you speak, that starts to affect how you think, and then your own sense of self and your identity and your individuality. These are norms. These are not in the Constitution. But that kind of analysis is important to then understanding how much do we want government to have that power today. If it starts getting to the point where your political views are being hampered or dictated by government because you're worried about your own security and your family, that's when the First Amendment is really, the gauntlet comes down. But again, not in the definition of free exercise, for example.
I had a long conversation on the show one time with Floyd Abrams, a great First Amendment lawyer. He calls the First Amendment the rock star of the Constitution. And he makes the point that the First Amendment specifically mentions the press, for example, it specifically mentions this free exercise of religion. I mean, they annotated particular areas that the framers were worried about having infringements.
Yeah, the press is a great point. That's also, I think, an area where we see a lot of national conversation about fake news or the press that's dishonest. And this is another place, I think, where technology intersects with the First Amendment. I tell people, imagine, my students will say, how do we know what's true and what's not? I said, go back to Michael J. Fox, Back to the Future, and get into your DeLorean and go to 1980 or 1985 and say, okay, what was the press back then? It was a few newspapers and a few national outlets. And there are norms, press norms, you probably know these better than I do, that govern how reporters report, how many sources, how accurate they need to be. That is not in the law.
Whether they're protected or not.
Exactly. Those are the kinds of things that have developed around the industry that protect and individual people who follow the press in terms of understanding, having a certain confidence level that there's integrity behind it. With the internet, of course, there's all kinds of information that's planted. We saw this with the 2016 Russia attack on our electoral process, planted specifically to distort our understanding of the truth. That of course intersects with the First Amendment. What does the First Amendment say about the press's ability to lie, for example? I don't know the answer to that necessarily. Of course, the press needs to be free so that we can get information about our government. It's an absolute foundational element to the First Amendment. But it gets thorny, it gets tricky, it's gray, it's not black and white, like a lot of the Constitution.
And you talk about how, and Abrams makes this point as well, that here in the United States, the content of your speech is even more, it's hyper-protected. It's more protected than other democracies even, Canada, Germany, Britain. Those instances, there are a lot of times where speech is reined in. But here in the United States, even as abhorrent and vitriolic and terrible as the speech may be, you're allowed to utter it.
And this is where we've seen sort of, I think, traditionally progressive or liberal organizations like the ACLU protect more conservative wings of the national populace that might sort of, for example, at a military funeral for someone who was a deceased veteran that was homosexual, making protests that are going to be painful for the family, for example, there are civil rights groups that will protect that speech on the theory that it's a slippery slope. Once you start regulating speech, pretty soon we're in an environment where the haves and the have-nots are determined by whoever's in power and if you're ideologically aligned with that person in power. And that's no longer a free country, so to speak.
It's horrible, but it ain't illegal. Yeah. Kim Whaley is my guest. She is a professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law. We're talking about her book that's a guide to the founding document of the American Experiment. It's called How to Read the Constitution and Why. A reminder that our conversation was recorded earlier, so we aren't taking any calls, emails, or tweets today. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. We'll have more with Kim Whaley when we return from this quick break. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, we're talking about an excellent book that unpacks, without legalese or esoteric jargon, the Constitution of the United States. Is it, as my guest suggests, at risk of being ignored or violated without consequence? Has technology changed and informed our understanding of this document that is admired here and around the world? Has the office of the presidency and the executive branch, as some have suggested, become too powerful? The political polarity our country has experienced for some time now seems to have ramped up considerably during the administration of Donald Trump. Is this polarity, this factionalization of the body politic, something that the framers of the Constitution anticipated? Does the Constitution reflect the self-evident truths alluded to in the Declaration of Independence, which was written more than a decade earlier? does it to this day secure the blessings of liberty to us and our posterity, as it aspired to do in 1787. My guest is Kim Whaley. She's a former assistant U.S. attorney and associate independent counsel during the Whitewater investigation, where she worked with, among others, Justice Brett Kavanaugh and former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. The book is called How to Read the Constitution and Why. It was published in June of 2019. We pre-recorded our conversation, so we won't be able to take your phone calls and emails today. So, Kim Whaley, I want to talk about the Second Amendment as well. And you say that all the controversy over the Second Amendment, this is the one having to do with guns, comes down to commas. I mean, it's like eat shoots and leaves, you know, that grammar book. And depending on where you put the commas, the sentences mean something very different.
So the big question is whether the Second Amendment's right to bear arms is about militias or it goes beyond that. And as I describe in the book, it depends on how you parse the commas. It is not black and white. And the Supreme Court historically viewed it one way, that is that it's limited to militias. And then the court in that famous Heller versus District of Columbia decision determined that it actually goes beyond protecting the right of militias to get guns to basically fight back on behalf of the government or maybe against the government, and that it protects the right of individuals to have handguns in their home for self-defense. It does not go beyond that today. But this is, I think, one place where people seem to think that the court has expanded the Second Amendment even further, and that's just not the case.
Yeah, you list a number of myths about the Second Amendment, one of which is that arms necessarily includes handguns and rifles and semi-automatic weapons. So you're saying that there are some limits. There's a limit to everything in the Constitution. I mean, it's not willy-nilly open season on every amendment.
Courts and lawyers use what we call balancing tests a lot, where you take one policy issue, a concern on one hand, you take a policy concern on the other, and you figure out what's the fair compromise there. So we just talked about the First Amendment. There's, you know, robust protection of speech, but speech through the utilization of child pornography is not protected. It's actually a crime. That's an example where the right to speak freely was outweighed by the harm to children and families and society by that kind of conduct. Likewise, under the Second Amendment, I don't think any Supreme Court justice would say the word arms should be defined to include plutonium for purposes of creating a nuclear bomb in your basement. Of course, weapons expand well beyond a handgun. And even Justice Scalia and others in that decision admitted that there's a line there in terms of the amount of arms you can have or the robustness of arms you can have for purposes of protecting your family.
You say that we might think twice about making gun safety for people who are concerned about gun regulation and gun safety, that it may be a mistake to make it first and foremost about the Second Amendment.
Yeah, this is another, I think, takeaway from the book. When we decide to let the Supreme Court resolve an issue as a matter of constitutional law, this happened with abortion as well, that decision then becomes essentially set in stone. It's as if, as I mentioned earlier, the Constitution itself was amended. Congress can't change that because the Constitution is the boss and the Supreme Court interprets it according to a Supreme Court decision. State regulators cannot change that. It's the top dog. So if we allow these difficult issues to percolate and get resolved legislatively, either at the federal legislative level or the state legislative level, they can continue to be tweaked. They can continue to evolve based on what the populace wants and not based on what five individuals with life tenure. And I respect everyone on the Supreme Court, but ultimately it comes down to five people, not even nine people. And when they make a determination under the Second Amendment or under the Due Process Clause for purposes of abortion, for example, or under the First Amendment, we saw this with the Citizens United decision, in which the court found that corporations, which are legal fictions, have First Amendment rights, and therefore we've seen a lot of money in politics. That can't change unless there's a constitutional amendment. And that decision, for example, vastly, I think, altered the relationship between the individual voter and their representative in Congress in ways that probably the framers didn't anticipate.
When I talked to George Will about a book he wrote called The Conservative Sensibility, he talked about the dichotomy between what he described as Madisonian interpretation of the Constitution, James Madison, one of the framers, and Wilsonian, Woodrow Wilson, who was the president at around the time of the First World War, who thought of the republic as being much more mature than it was when the framers had to do their job. Therefore, a stronger executive, a more powerful executive with all these agencies, et cetera, was called for. The government had to be bigger because the country was bigger. There were more people and there were more things to deal with. Do you buy that that analysis of Madison versus Wilson in terms of the way the constitutional perspective has come down? Because it's kind of proxy for Democrats and Republicans in a lot of ways.
Well, I do think that the massive sort of shifting of the demographics of the country, the population, the complexities of our society, the global economy, all of that do require updating of our points of view when it comes to interpreting the Constitution. Certainly, for example, the notion that, you know, California has two senators and Wisconsin has two senators. Senators have a lot of power, appointment power, federal judges and cabinet members, for example. The Californians' vote matters a lot less for that, for example, than the Wisconsin voter. The framers didn't anticipate this kind of population growth. But I don't think I agree with the idea that that justifies a more powerful executive. And I say this in part because I teach a class called Federal Courts, which is about the separation of powers. And recently, the last time I taught it, I can't remember the case, but there was dicta around presidential powers in one of these older cases in which the court said, well, of course, whoever arises to the level of the presidency will adhere to what you and I have called norms. They will have jumped through enough hoops. You think about when you apply for a job, say a teacher, there'll be a background check. You'll have to have a certain level of education. You'll call references to make sure there's integrity. It's not just does the piece of paper make you qualified. It's as a person, are you the kind of person that should be teaching first graders, for example? And I think the framers assumed that the political process would produce only those kinds of candidates that satisfied that kind of background check notion. And we're not necessarily seeing that. We're not seeing the accountability in that regard, not just with respect to elected officials, but also appointed officials. So what I also suggest in the book is that we have to think about these offices not as the person who currently holds it, but as the office itself. How big are those, you know, belt and suspenders, right? Because however much we enlarge the power of that office, that baton of power gets passed to the next person. And it only, presidency, for example, it's only 8 years, assuming that that's respected. And so we can pretty much bet that at some point in our lifetimes, if we're lucky enough to live long lives, there will be someone elected to that office that we don't agree with ideologically, politically, but that person has that same amount of power. The last election was highly polarized. If you voted for Trump, you might but not like the notion of a Hillary Clinton having the kind of power that this presidency has amassed in the last few years. And that's, I think, the focus on the forest and not the trees that I mean, back to your original question, I'm not sure I agree with the idea that expanding the office is safe because we're just smarter than we were when the framers were around.
It's interesting. One of the other things that George Will talks about is that he says that the Constitution creates four really important institutions: the executive, the judiciary, the legislative, and the Electoral College. He lists that as the fourth one. He's a big fan of the Electoral College. And when we talk about the imbalance between that voter in Montana and that voter in, you know, California, and they have an unequal weight in the body politic, is that a matter of size of the country and geographic spread only, or is it also a matter of ideology?
Well, I think the Electoral College, kind of like the notion of a Republican government, the idea being you'll elect officials to Congress, to the Electoral College, people are go to the Electoral College, who will exercise independent judgment. One thing, and I'm doing a new book on voting rights, that even surprised me as a constitutional law person is how much of voting rights are state by state. So the Electoral College, whether the Electoral College is casting votes based on percentage, that is 60% for candidate X and 40% for candidate Y, or winner takes all, that is all the electoral delegates go to whoever had the majority, that makes a big difference. If it's splitting percentages, then those voters who voted for the minority candidate still have a voice in the Electoral College and the decision as to who can be elected president. So I think there is a disconnect between how much each of our votes matter and how the system actually functions. And in an ironic way, the Supreme Court many, many times, and federal courts in general, will say, we saw this with gerrymandering, for example, in the recent decision by the Supreme Court this year, the idea being, well, we'll let the electoral process do that because then the voters make that determination. But there's a lot of barriers to voters actually having an impact in the way that that theoretical punt assumes they do.
Yeah, it's barriers to the voters getting to the table, you know, to have the conversation. Kim Whaley is my guest. It's midday. We pre-recorded our conversation, so we're not taking calls and emails today. The book is called How to Read the Constitution and Why. I'm Tom Hall. When we talk about equal protection under the law, you have a section in the book about immigration. It's important to remember that even undocumented citizens, undocumented people who are in the country for whatever reason, are still protected by the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, and in a way, they actually have even more protections than in certain circumstances than other people. On the theory, again, balancing, the court said, listen, they don't have a way to go to the ballot booth to ensure that their rights are protected. So the Constitution has to be especially vigilant in making sure government doesn't mow them down, so to speak. But that is, again, I think, an assumption that the Constitution makes a distinction between, you know, certain worthy people and certain unworthy people. And that's not the case once you're in the country.
What worries you about the Constitution and the fate of the republic, literally?
What worries me is that of the three-legged stool that holds up our constitutional democracy, the three branches of government, the Congress is not protecting its prerogative and actually doing what it's supposed to do in terms of checking the other two branches of the presidency. We're in an environment where we're having a discussion as to whether it's even appropriate for the Congress to do any oversight whatsoever of the presidency. That's a certain point of view. I do disagree with it, frankly, because the idea is that the Congress has to check both of the other two branches. Otherwise, if government gets too powerful, then, and there's no checks, what happens? There's a direct connection between that and our individual rights. The right to raise our children the way we want, to educate them, to get our medical care, to go from one state to another, to enter into contracts that aren't based on our socioeconomic status, for example, or our race, whether you're allowed to or not allowed to enter into contract. Lots of things that we just take for granted, like the air we breathe, but in other parts of the world, that's not the case. Or justice is doled out based on whether you're politically aligned with who's in power or whether you can bribe a judge or bribe a police officer. These things, we just run around as Americans thinking this is just the way life is. It's not. People stop at stop signs and they stop at red lights. It's very orderly that way because there are consequences. We respect the courts. We generally respect law enforcement. We understand that we have to abide as a nation in these common rules. And that protects everybody. If my neighbor's rights are protected, then that's limiting government's ability to infringe on my rights. And it's that connection I really worry about. The Congress not doing its job and people not understanding that limiting government, period, protects all of our rights, regardless of whether you're an undocumented immigrant or were born in this country.
Kim Whaley teaches courses in administrative law, civil procedure, and federal courts at the University of Baltimore Law School. Her gem of a book is called How to Read the Constitution and Why. And Kim, as you say, at the end of the book, it really all comes down to voting. We've got to at least exercise that very, very cherished and precious right.
Yes.
Thank you so much. This is a terrific read, and it's been fun talking to you. I appreciate it.
Great to be here. Thanks, Tom.
That's it for us today in this pre-recorded edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for subscribing to our podcast, for following us on Twitter, at Midday WYPR. You can follow me on Twitter, at Tom Hall WYPR, and you can listen to all of our broadcasts and leave comments at wypr.org/midday. On behalf of all of us on the Midday team, thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.